In Ouagadougou, an unusual trial is taking place. 14 suspects are charged with involvement in the assassination 34 years ago of Thomas Sankara, at the time Burkina Faso's president and still today a figure of considerable significance in his country and his continent. Sankara was 37 when he died and had been president for 4 years. He had seized power in a coup d'état and his time in office was scarcely less turbulent. Sankara's most obvious legacy is the iconography of his country. He chose the name Burkina Faso to replace the French colonial designation Upper Volta, implemented its handsome flag, wrote the national anthem, and by way of illustrating his creed of revolutionary self-reliance, designed a coat of arms featuring a crossed pickaxe and Kalashnikov. Sankara's presidency ended as it began, with a coup d'état organized by his friend and ally Blaise Compaoré, who fancied being president himself. Compaoré is among those charged with Sankara's murder, but sulks in exile in the Ivory Coast, having been deposed in 2014. Thomas Sankara is remembered now as much for his ideals and his image as his accomplishment. In this respect, at least, the common description of Sankara as Africa's Che Guevara is accurate. He also shared with the Cuban revolutionary a ruthless distaste for opposition. But his achievements were not negligible. He was an effective modernizer, animated substantially by an interpretation of the philosophy of Pan-Africanism. Who was Thomas Sankara? What can this trial hope to accomplish? And what does the creed of Pan-Africanism mean now? This is The Foreign Desk.
It's a very big deal. People have been waiting for 34 years for this, whether they were alive when it happened or it's just been passed down. I mean, Sankara still has a very big following. In the courtroom, you know, on the first day of the trial, the families of the victims were there just saying how this was long overdue, how they were looking forward to a fair and just trial. So it is quite a big deal here.
Pan-Africanism now means the decolonization, the unification, and the liberation of Africa. When we say Africa, we go back to Wole Soyinka's conception of Africa, where he says that Africa no longer stops where salt water licks its shores. Africa is wherever African people are.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. For the latest on the trial itself, I'm joined by Sam Mednick, a journalist based in Burkina Faso. Sam, first of all, why has it taken until now? Why has it taken 34 years for anybody to be brought to justice for Thomas Sankara's death?
Well, so after Sankara was killed in 1987, one of the main people accused of the murder was Blaise Compaoré, who then ruled the country for the next nearly 30 years. So people say that his desire to open an investigation into what happened was quite limited. Sankara's widow did file a criminal complaint in 1997 over the murder, but it took 15 years for the Supreme Court to rule that the investigation could continue. And so very little progress was made while Compaoré was in power, and he was ousted in 2014 in a popular uprising.
Compaoré is, of course, one of the people charged with the murder, though he is not appearing in court. Who are the others? Are these all people who were Compaoré's accomplices at the time?
Yeah, there are 14 people being charged, including Compaoré. And yeah, people who worked with him, like his security chief, Hyacinthe Kafando, his right-hand man, Gilbert Diandre, as well as the doctor who signed the death certificate, Diebra John Christophe. And they're all being charged for a mix of things, including complicity, undermining state security, concealing corpses. The doctor's being charged with falsifying public documents. And then there's others. Two are being tried in absentia, like Compaoré as well as Kafando. And then the others are actually in court.
Is it possible to gauge how big a deal this trial has been in Burkina Faso? Obviously, Thomas Sankara, a very, very important figure in Burkina Faso's history, but obviously Burkina Faso, a country now, I guess, in which most of the population would have no real recollection of him. Is this something that has the entire country on the edge of its seat?
It definitely does. It's a very big deal. People have been waiting for 34 years for this, whether they were alive when it happened or it's just been passed down. I mean, Sankara still has a very big following. In the courtroom, you know, on the first day of the trial, the families of the victims were there just saying how this was long overdue, how they were looking forward to a fair and just trial. It's being heavily covered. So it is quite a big deal here.
What kind of tone have we seen in the coverage in the Burkinabe press?
Sort of a very kind of wait and see tone, that this is great that this is happening, this is good that this is a big step moving forward, particularly because President Kabore, who won re-election in November, he ran on a platform of reconciliation. So this is very much in line with what he was running on. And so there's, you know, the press is covering it as this is happening, people are looking forward to a just trial, but sort of like a wait and see as to what happens and if this is going to be done, I think, with everyone being happy the way that it is being done, independently and justly.
Is it being seen as a big regional story as well? Are you seeing lots of reporters from elsewhere in West Africa or perhaps even further afield coming to town for it?
There was definitely international press that came in for it. The trial was actually followed by FESPACO, which is the largest film festival in Africa. So they were sort of back to back. So a lot of international press kind of came in, covered the trial, and then stayed for the festival. But it's gotten a lot of international press, regional press, but elsewhere as well.
And from the trial so far, what have we learned? Have there been any astounding revelations of any kind?
There's only been the first day, and on that first day, they chose the jury. And then there were two main conclusions that first day, basically that there will be no recording in the courtroom. You can't take audio or photographs or any video. And then some of the defense lawyers requested a delay because they wanted to review some of the documents, which they say they got late. So it's been delayed and will resume again on the 25th of October.
Now, as we were discussing, Blaise Compaoré, who is certainly the most prominent of the defendants, is not in the dock and is unlikely to turn up. Have we heard from him at all since this action began?
We haven't heard from him, but his lawyers did put out a statement before the day of the first trial saying, quote unquote, he won't surrender or attend the trial because he was never summoned for questioning before being charged, is what they alleged. And so he won't be coming back.
Does Compaoré still have a constituency in Burkina Faso? Are there demographics he's still popular with at all?
He does have a following in Burkina Faso, definitely. His party has been revamped and reshaped, and some in the party have tried to sort of put a bit of a distance. But he does still have a following among the population, and some people say as well within the military.
On that thought, and just finally, is there any concern at all that this trial, whatever the result and whatever information is yielded from proceedings, are there any concerns that it might stir up some kind of trouble?
I think right now the general feeling is that people are happy it's going ahead. And again, the waiting and seeing to see how it unfolds and reiterating that the most important thing is that it's fair and just. Sankara experts say no one should expect any smoking gun in terms of suspected involvement by other countries like France, who have been suspected to be involved, and that could disappoint people, but not necessarily to the extent of unrest or violence.
Sam Mednick, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. The figure at the centre of this trial is by now at least as much myth as man. For more on who Thomas Sankara was and what he means to Burkina Faso now, I'm joined by the Ouagadougou-based journalist Umar Zombre. Umar, first of all, can you give us a general sense of how Thomas Sankara is thought of in Burkina Faso today?
Today we can say that Thomas Sankara is in the memory of many young people, mostly young people from 20 years old, up to 40, and sometimes 50. But those who have known him, some of them have mitigated feeling of the revolution time.
So do you think it's fair to say that he's more popular among people born since his death?
Yes, definitely. Now he's very popular. It's not only in Burkina Faso, it's across Africa. He is popular for his fight that he fought. He is popular for his mind against imperialism. He is popular for his view and the idea that one should commit, should rely to himself if he wants to go to development. He shouldn't rely to anybody else. And that is what he tried to teach people when he was leading the country in 1984 to 1987 when he was killed. He fought against corruption, he fought against nepotism, because as you see in Africa, if you take in many countries, they are still dealing, trying to fight against corruption, trying to reach food sufficiency. But in time of revolution, he fought hardly about corruption. And also within 3 years, the country produced enough to feed the people. So that is the good image that people, young generation, still have in their memory.
How much of that nostalgia for him, though, especially among those people who would have no direct memory of his government, how much of that is to do with dissatisfaction and disillusionment with what followed him?
As an example, the former president, Jean-Baptiste Ouédraogo, he wrote his memories in the book saying, "My Path of Truth." In this book, it depicted the time of Sankara, the way he was ruling, like a dictator, as someone who was imposing his view to people. And this book has been rejected by many people, mainly the young people, who say that what he wrote is not correct. And he had to go through media and say, "I wrote my perception on the time of revolution, as it's not meeting the aspiration of people, so I am apologizing." He was very severely treated by those who didn't even read his book, because in his book he said Thomas Sankara was not perfect. People said you have to pay respect on Thomas Sankara as an icon, someone who fought for your freedom, someone who fought for the development of the country, and you as a president, what did you do? You didn't do anything, so you have to pay respect and not say anything bad on him. So that shows that there is a conflict between those who have the good image of Thomas Sankara and those who lived in the time of Thomas Sankara and who did not really like it.
Do you see more and more manifestations of Thomas Sankara in the country's politics and culture? Do you see his face on posters in public? Are there things being named after him? Has he become more of a touchstone, do you think, the further we get from his death?
So if you take in Ouagadougou, you will see many public buildings that have been renamed after him. You have the University Thomas Sankara, which is the new one, built and then functional 2 or 3 years ago. And then you have avenues that have been renamed, baptized after him. And you have in the country many tokens that have been renamed after Thomas Sankara to show that there is an importance given to him and given to his vision. And you will have people claiming to be Sankarist parties. So people have taken his name, his vision, and created a party. And even today, we have the Sankarist Party, who is now member of the majority ruling party.
Just as a final thought then, whichever way this trial may go, do you think the fact of having the trial has made Thomas Sankara even more prominent than he already was in Burkina Faso's consciousness?
No, I don't think that this trial has made him more prominent, but I think that he was prominent because people knew him. And even if this trial did not start, people will still have him in mind. I think what this trial has contributed to is that it will enlighten people and those who are Thomas Sankara fellows and those who are still feeding this idea, this vision, this flame of Thomas Sankara, to know what happened during that day of October the 15th, to know who killed Thomas Sankara and why, and also how they did it. So this trial will bring this light to people who still have Thomas Sankara as an icon. And also maybe it will help Burkina Faso people to move forward, because they've been waiting this trial for 34 years and now it's happening. That means that there is one part of the history that is very important of Burkina Faso that will be brought to public. And after this trial, maybe people will come together, and then this will help the government wish it, will contribute to bring people, to bring reconciliation among Burkina citizens.
Umar Zombre in Ouagadougou, thank you for joining us. Thomas Sankara was an adherent of the movement and or philosophy known as Pan-Africanism, an idea which has meant different things in different times and different places. To look at what Pan-Africanism means now, I'm joined finally by Professor Rayland Rabaka, Director of the Center for African and African-American Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. Rayland is also the editor of the Routledge Handbook of Pan-Africanism. Well, first of all, let's start with that term. How would we, or I guess how could we, define Pan-Africanism now?
Pan-Africanism now means the decolonization, the unification, and the liberation of Africa. When we say Africa, we go back to Wole Soyinka's conception of Africa, where he says that Africa no longer stops where salt water licks its shores. Africa is wherever African people are. So again, Africa, we have to include the African diaspora. That means those of us who are living outside of the African continent now because of the enslavement of African people, because of colonization. So there are a range of factors that play into why we are conceiving of Africa as something global as opposed to purely continental, those 55 countries, if you will.
That aspect you mentioned of decolonization, is that a new addition or inclusion to the idea of Pan-Africanism, or has that always been there, at least in the modern post-colonial period?
Absolutely. So decolonization is something that really gains a lot of traction coming out of W.E.B. Du Bois's work at the Manchester Conference in 1945. Certainly picks up even more traction once you get to the Negritude movement. People like Aimé Césaire, Léopold Senghor, Léon Dumas, and Césaire has a book called Discourse on Colonialism. And in that book, he talks about this boomerang effect that some of the racism, the colonialism, this taking capitalism global, those things actually come back to folks that sort of put them out there. It's almost like a karma kind of concept of colonialism. And it's very, very interesting because decolonization says that we actually have to call into question the entire colonial empire and structure before we can ever really unite and liberate African people.
I want to come back to that idea of unity, but first of all, to go back to the origins of Pan-Africanism, is there something that you would think of as a recognized founding text or founder of the idea?
A lot of people are going to go to the Conference on Africa at the end of the 19th century, if I'm correct, about 1893. Or so. This happened again outside of Africa. So I want to be very clear. The concept of Pan-Africanism starts in the African diaspora. So it does not start on the African continent. It starts in the diaspora. And then you go to someone like Henry Sylvester Williams, Trinidadian lawyer. And then, of course, taking it over from Henry Sylvester Williams would be W.E.B. Du Bois. They had this incredible Pan-African conference in London in 1900. And at that conference, Du Bois issued this address to the world. And in that, he called for the unification of Africa. He called for serious critiques and resistance to colonialism. But even before he did that, Andrew, Du Bois articulated in this essay called The Conservation of Races in 1897, a concept of pan-Negroism. So before we had Pan-Africanism, it started out and they were calling it pan-Negroism, basically, essentially understanding the uniqueness of the African experience as we get ready to go into the 20th century. So a late 19th century concept starts in the African diaspora, and then this idea moves to the continent, particularly with Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement. So he's going to really sort of popularize this concept, this Back to Africa movement.
So do you think the idea of Pan-Africanism either does now or has always meant something different outside Africa than it does inside Africa?
Wow, you are going to get us in so much trouble. This is a very provocative and controversial question, because here's one of the ironies, and I just want to be as intellectually honest as I possibly can be. This has been a raging discussion that has haunted the entire history of Pan-Africanism, because again, it's when a lot of the continental African students went to university, a lot of times they would have to go right back to the colonial empire that was colonizing them. So this is Léopold Senghor goes to the Sorbonne, Kwame Nkrumah, as you know, goes to London and then comes here to the United States of America. So the idea they sort of realize, wow, the African diaspora is valuing the entirety of the continent, where a lot of continental Africans were thinking at that time mostly about their specific country. You see, I can't point to a specific country where I come from. So Du Bois and them claimed the entire continent, and that idea is novel, is new, and it can also be used as a political and a cultural tool to help to bring about what we're calling right now the African Renaissance.
Is it also fair to assume that there are a great many different versions of Pan-Africanism? Because it seems unlikely that, to cite a number of random examples, Haile Selassie, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Julius Nyerere, and Muammar Gaddafi all had exactly the same idea of it.
No, there are as many versions of Pan-Africanism as there are jazz music or rock or reggae. So there's lots of different strains of it. I teach it to my students like this. Pan-Africanism, it's like the root, the trunk of a tree, the roots. And the fruits of it are going to be very, very different, depending on whether you're in Haiti, depending on whether you're in Grenada with somebody like Maurice Bishop, depending on whether you're in Guinea with somebody like Sekou Touré, depending on whether you're in Harlem, if you're somebody like W.E.B. Du Bois. And then let us bring up all of the Pan-African feminists. Right? And Pan-African womanism, the fact that, again, we have some serious critiques of patriarchy. We have some serious critiques of misogyny going on. And so what I tried to do in my work is to bring an intersectional interpretation to Pan-Africanism, saying that no one black person has a monopoly on blackness. This is what the Negritude movement meant by Africanité, the unique humanity, identity, and personality of African people. That means that no one group has a monopoly, not anybody on the continent and not one group in the diaspora either. Only collectively, only together can we sort of articulate 21st century versions of what it means to be African in this world.
But has Pan-Africanism, do you think, has it essentially been largely an idea of an identity, or has there been a political imperative guiding it towards, for example, an actual political union of the continent of Africa in the same way that we might think of the European Union as a union of, well, now most of the continent of Europe?
Okay, absolutely. Growing out of, you mentioned Haile Selassie, growing out of what Nkrumah and Selassie and Yere and Sekou Touré and so many figures at that time called the Organization of African Unity. So that's in the 50s and the 60s. In the 60s in particular, that evolves into what we're calling right now the African Union. So there's been a long discourse going all the way back to the 50s and the 60s where people have been talking, kicking around this concept of an African Union. So it's going to be very important to understand that that is a reality. And in fact, in my edited volume, we have whole essays on the African Union, some of the successes, some of the pitfalls of it, and has it ever really worked? But let me go back more directly to your question. Absolutely, you have hit the nail on the head that at the heart of Pan-Africanism is, for many folks, it's an idea, and merely an idea that has to do with identity and culture. For some of the rest of us, it's also a movement. So again, I'm going to sound like Frantz Fanon in The Wretched of the Earth, but Fanon talks about how do we translate our ideas into action. Pan-Africanism, for me, is both an idea and also a movement. When we say a movement, we need to understand that successive generations continue movements. Right now, in the United States, the modern face of the civil rights movement, of the Black Power movement, we call it Black Lives Matter. What we have done, again, I'm a member of the hip-hop generation if you haven't figured it out, what we have done is remixed our parents and grandparents' black protest movements and made it speak to the special times of the 21st century. So if you were to ask me, Andrew, about the modern face, at least the modern movement, when we move Pan-Africanism beyond an idea, one of the modern faces of it is called the Black Lives Matter movement. It's global now. It's called the Black Lives Matter Global Network. It's all over in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, right there where you're at in Europe. Come on, man. I mean, this is a global thing. So people need to understand the origins and the evolution of Pan-Africanism. Listen, Andrew, what if I'm telling you that what Du Bois and them call Pan-Africanism, today we're often calling Black Internationalism? black transnationalism. Again, all bunch of academic buzzwords, but if you really study it, you'd be like, wow, the core principles are almost identical. So they just have a new name for something that Garvey and them was doing a long time ago.
We come into this program talking about the trial going on in Burkina Faso in the case of people who are on the hook for the murder of Thomas Sankara. How would you say, though, that Pan-Africanism has evolved as an idea in that relatively short time between when he was espousing his version of it and now?
I would say that decolonization has made all the difference in the world. By decolonization, we mean literally to call into question and to acknowledge that African people have been colonized. And when we say colonized, we don't just mean the land and our labor, but our lives, our minds. And so if you go to the great Kikuyu, the great Kenyan writer, Ngugi has a book called Decolonizing the Mind, right? If you go to somebody like a Bob Marley in Redemption Song says, emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. That's a decolonial lyric. But if most people don't know anything about decolonization, decolonization could come up to them and kiss them in the mouth and they wouldn't even know who kissed them. That's the problematic and the pitfall of post-colonialism. My work calls into question, are we really in a period after colonialism? You can have independence, you can raise up a new flag, you can change the name of your country, but if the superstructure, if the power structure, if the political economy of the country remains the same, and again, connected to the former colonial empire, are we really in a period after? Maybe we are in a decolonial age. Maybe we are in a decolonial era or epoch. So I'm more interested in decoloniality. And decolonization, as Fanon says, as both a process and a program. See, it's ongoing. It's never ending. I have to continue to, I'm going to say it slow, and I don't want to offend you, brother. I'm going to say it slow. Watch this. We have to decolonize, Andrew, and then re-Africanize. It's the re-Africanization that is at the heart of my conception of Pan-Africanism. And you might ask me, what does that mean?
I was just about to get to that.
Okay, go ahead. I love it. Come on, man. Let's talk about it.
That idea of re-Africanization, is there a way that you can define what that means?
I would say that we have to ask ourselves, what is racial colonization? The difference of what happened to African people is that you have a simultaneous racialization and colonization. And we need to understand that the concept of race was created in Europe. In fact, in Germany in the middle of the 15th century. So it's not like Africans are running around. We have any great preoccupation with race. It's a foreign concept. It was projected onto us. And with simultaneous racialization and colonization, you get racial colonialism. That's a kind of dehumanization. And that started in about 1441, when the Portuguese came to Africa and began this enslavement, right, and this colonization. And so we have been dehumanized. And the response to that is to rehumanize ourselves. This is why Fanon and the Wretched of the Earth is so powerful. That rehumanization and decolonization is one of the tools that we use to rehumanize ourselves. And since we're African people, we need a re-Africanization, meaning we need to historically root and culturally ground ourselves in African culture.
Rayland, thank you. That was Professor Rayland Rabaka of the University of Colorado Boulder. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. Do also keep an eye and an ear out for this week's installment of The Big Interview, in which I speak to the former commander of the International Space Station, Chris Hadfield. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.